So, anyone out there with any further comments on this subject? George, we kind of went a little bit off topic as far as you're concerned. I hope you got most of the information that you wanted tonight. And as always, as Dick may rest in peace used to say, you know, if you don't, you could always come back and ask the same question again.
KD2BCQ. Yeah, I mean, you've already answered all my questions, and while I'm here, I want to give a quick shout-out to Ed. Hey, buddy, I really appreciate everything you've been doing for me. I have to read a lot more. I mean, I ran out of questions. I don't have enough knowledge to have any questions. And as far as out of the scope of what I'm in, I don't know if I have a scope yet. So, I mean, anything you guys talk about is new to me, and it's something I'm learning. And, you know, as I get, it'll make more sense, or I'll recognize the need out of your discussion.
Well, yeah, George, I mean, this is all a process. You don't kind of pop out of the egg knowing everything or knowing what you don't know. You learn a little bit, you digest it, you rummage around, you think about it. It tends to lead to more questions. You ask those questions. Hopefully those get answered. And, you know, like most things, it's kind of like an onion. There's layer upon layer upon layer upon layer.
I think that's one of the things that I like about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I often say that the beauty of this particular hobby is both the depth and the breadth of possible things that you could do with it. You know, different people find different interests. There are guys who love CW, and they go down to 80 and 40 meters and tap away. There are other guys who love microwave. There are guys who love digital. And there's a place for all of us, low scan TV, amateur digital, amateur analog TV, all kinds of stuff. Single sideband, DXing, the rad chewing, you name it, we got it. So you just find a couple of things that interest you and dig as deep as you want. And know that there are guys out there that made the same trip that you did and are more than happy to help you along.
One of the things I love about it, I've never met such a group of unique and interesting and incredible people. I'm enjoying the hell out of that. It's just something very new to me. I mean, I'm not a spring chicken, and there's a lot of good people out there, a lot of bad people out there. But here, it just seems like the percentage is very heavily weighted toward the good side. And yeah, I mean, personally, I feel drawn and connected to NVIS, and I also I have a hunger to learn about antenna and antenna design.
Well, you know, when I got my license 9 years ago, I had read the ARRS book. I know basically how electronics works, but you know, antennas are almost like a mystery, and so. I looked around and wasn't getting anyone to kind of tell me how to do antennas, so I just picked up a bunch of books. I found this TechNet, and I found Dick, and Mel, unfortunately, K2KY, had just passed away, but John came on board, and I learned from the greats, and I read a lot. There's a lot that you can read. Again, you need a good BS meter, but as long as it's well-calibrated, the Internet is an exceptional source of information, and ARRL books, the fundamental books, are excellent. I don't know if I would buy every single book that the ARRL publishes, because that's a lot of books and not that many pages.
Hey, that's one. I'm reading here as you're talking. I'm kind of listening on Google. And I'm looking at all the kits that you can buy. It looks like they're pre-made dipoles. It looks like, from the pictures, they look like they're made out of coax cable. I actually had several rolls of naked copper wire that I was intending to use for my antennas. I got to believe that naked copper wire would probably be the best the best thing to use when making an antenna. Is there any reason I would want to look at something other than copper when I'm making an antenna?
Well, the quick, simple answer is no. Copper is the least expensive, most conducting metal. I say it that way because someone inevitably will say, aha, silver is more conducting. Yeah, but silver costs you a heck of a lot more than copper. So copper wire is fine. It doesn't necessarily have to be naked. By just putting an insulator over it, it might detune it ever so slightly so that the resonance lengths are a little different. You can correct for them very easily, and they're less exposed to the elements. So I would suggest, all things being equal, to use insulated wire. But, you know, you don't have to. You can use non-insulated wire. The wires that people use primarily are copper. Sometimes they'll use copper-clad steel. Basically, it's a steel core with copper surrounding it. It has the benefit of the same conduction, since at RF frequencies there's something called the skin effect, and the currents flow on the surface, not in the core, and the steel core gives it a little bit better strength and less stretchiness, called ductility. So those are the two major, you know, most people's antennas, wire antennas, are made out of copper. If you're putting together beams and such, that's when people start to use them.
KD2PCQ. Thank you for that. I already own the copper, the naked copper, as I call it. So I'm pretty much going to stick with that. I don't want to dip it in rubber. But one thing, you know, it's weird. I found myself dreaming about antennas last night. Strange, but true. And I was thinking about different size antennas and half-wave and quarter-wave antennas. And as you go from half, you go from a full-wave to a half-wave. Like, if you go to a half-wave 20, is that the same thing as a full-wave 10? And then I got to thinking of, well, as you shrink your antenna, and you try to put the same current through it, you're going to have more and more, you're going to start to heat them up, you're going to start to cook them, the smaller the antenna gets. And then I started thinking in terms of superconductors. Now, I know you're not going to know, just forget superconductors because of the price and the inavailability to, like, amateurs. But is there something between copper and superconductor that you know of or might have heard of that would allow you to make a smaller antenna and still put the same amounts of current through it that you would with a much larger antenna?
Okay, you're going into this, unfortunately, the wrong way. It's not the fact of if you shorten something, the resistance goes up. In point of fact, if you shorten a conductor, the resistance goes down. What you should be dealing with is the concept of most antennas are called standing wave antennas, which means that the wave will go to the edge and then bounce off of it and go back to the feed point and then bounce off that and go back. So you want something a certain length so that there's a resonant quality so that the waves don't crash into each other and out of sync and destroy themselves. So it's the same thing like if you're sitting there at a swing. If you don't have the right rhythm for the swing, it's a mess. You have to come up with the right rhythm, and what right rhythm is based upon the length of the chain. The same thing as the wiring. So that's not what's going on. It's not a matter of resistance. Now, there's something a little bit more esoteric, unfortunately, called radiation resistance, and as you shrink a radiator and then electronically retune it, you decrease the radiation resistance, which you would think would be a good thing, but it's a bad thing, because radiation resistance is really the effective resistance, except instead of heat, it's the RF going out, which is what you want. The lower your radiation resistance, the more effect the regular resistance of insertion loss of the components have in undermining the efficiency of the antenna.
Thank you, Roy. I'm going to have to let that cook a little bit. I heard what you said, and I kind of understand it, but I can't visualize it. So I'm going to work on that for a while, but thank you.
Okay, very good. Well, like I said before, it's always good not to quite understand some of it. because it gives you a little bit of a chance to mull it around in your head. And I sort of, when I threw it out, I kind of, that's not entry-level stuff. I mean, I used to have strange discussions with the Dick K2RIW about radiation resistance. So feel fine that you didn't quite catch it this time. You'll catch it the next time or the time after that. So, George, think of this as an asset. If you need a question solved or if you want an opinion, this is as good a place as any. Ed will be out there to answer your questions on the repeater. A lot of the other people will be more than happy to answer your questions as well. Yes, Wesley.
I think the problem here for some folks is that they don't really understand some terms. So, what is insertion loss? If you could explain that. What is VSWR? VSWR. How to operate with. It is funny, but I've seen so many guys who do not know how bird operates. Just say something about the clock, something about the bird, and then you compare that measurement to the measurement that you could make with the VNA. So by pointing that in VNA we're not dealing with any signal at all. We don't have a transmitter. We don't have our rig connected to it. If you could say a few words about that, starting from insertion loss, that would be probably helpful.
Okay, Wesley, it's a couple of words about a lot of things, so it's probably going to end up to be a lot of things. Number one, insertion loss is simply any resistance between your transmitter and the actual radiating element. This includes the coax, it includes the antenna tuner, it includes the balun, it includes the impedance matching circuits, everything. So that's insertion loss. That's resistance, which is generating heat loss, which is energy lost from the system as opposed to radiating RF off of your antenna. So it is within the realm of possibilities. As I mentioned before, to have a 160-meter resonant hamstick sitting on a fender in a car, and the insertion loss will take up 99% of the energy, and the radiation resistance or the radiated power will take up 1%. So that's insertion loss. VSWR is voltage standing wave ratio. It is the difference between the, it can be defined 5,000 different ways. It can be defined as the impedance mismatch. In other words, if your antenna is not resonant and is not operating at 50 ohms, but operating at 100 ohms, and everything else is 50 ohms, then your VSWR is going to be 2 to 1. How do you find your VSWR? Well, there's more, at least two tricky ways of doing it. As Wesley mentioned, there's the bird watt meter. Bird watt meter is a brand of directional watt meters, which means it can read the power going in one direction, and then you turn the plug around because it has a diode in it, and it will tell you the power going in the other direction. And the beauty of RF is you can have two completely different currents going in two completely different directions. If you have no loss in your transmission line, by finding out the forward current, the forward power and the reverse power, you can calculate the standing wave ratio or the voltage standing wave ratio, which is the same thing. Unfortunately, if your transmission line is not so good and you have a lot of insertion loss in your transmission line, it will read a reverse power much lower than is really going on in the system because it's being soaked up and turned into heat. So that's how you would calculate the VSWR of a bird watt meter, and in the cases of transmission-like problems, you would miss them. A VNA, a vector network analyzer, let me drop for a second, I don't want to time out. A vector network analyzer analyzes the impedance. It analyzes the reactants, inductance, the reactants, the resistance, the phase angle, all those things are calculated. So rather than be fooled by a lossy coaxial cable, it will simply send the signal back up to the antenna, get a reflection back, and interpret the phase relationship and the impedance. So it'll go up there, and if it sees a 100 ohm impedance at the antenna feed, it will come back and report that you have a 2-to-1 vislock. So I think I've touched on all four of those, Wesley. If I haven't done it to your, as you were expecting, please let me know.
It's perfect. You did it the perfect job. The only thing that I would have is you use the word resistance. For some people, most of the people I believe know what is impedance. Impedance is made from three factors: physical resistance of a resistor, or the antenna that is a resistor, the wire that is the resistor, anything. Capacitive component of it, which would be capacitive reactance, and inductive component of it, which would be inductive reactance. So capacitive reactance, inductive reactance, and resistance. In most of the cases, resistance is omittable. That means resistance is so small that we can exclude it. But then we have a big role between inductive reactance and capacitive reactance. And those are measured in ohms. So it means you could actually reach the impedance of the antenna at 50 ohm, where the resistive component is omittable. It's so small that we can exclude it. So that's important. Let me drop.
You've got to realize it's complex quantities. Yeah, that's passive reactants and the inductive reactants. They're really complex quantities, and those formulas that calculate the return loss take into account the real imaginary. Like, you can have a perfect 50 ohm load, and if you have a capacitance series or across it, you'll have a very high return. You'll have a very low return loss because you'll get a big reflection. You really got to look at the equations, and you have to work it out with the vector map.
Yep. So actually, I'm from the old school. The biggest problem of mine was dealing with DBs. But talking about the insertion loss. Insertion loss is the loss of the signal when traveling in and out of the given circuit, or traveling into a component and out of the component. So into the component, out of the component. If your signal is 100% going into a component and coming out there is a loss, it is described as an insertion loss, and it is measured in dBs. So that's one of the factors usually that is, but if you're not satisfied with dBs, if you're not really comfortable with the dBs when I am not, then you can convert dBs to volts, and most of the even old DNAs, they have a ability for you to choose which units you're going to have it displayed at. So that's one of the things. And if we instead of the word resistance, which is not important, mostly not important, we use a word impedance, then we are actually on the same page. That's all right.
Well, that resistance is what we're talking about. Really, attenuation. That would be a better term for it. As the wave is traveling down the transmission line, it's attenuating. And that's why when it goes down, let's say you have an open-ended line, you have, let's say, a 2 dB loss to the end of the line, you get a full reflection, you get another 2 dB coming back, and looking into that line, it would look like you have a 4 dB return loss, and you can convert return loss into VSWR, and it won't be infinite because of the loss in the line or attenuation. over.
Hold on. Okay, let me see if I got it. Okay, very good. AC2GX here again. We're going to get deep into the weeds here. You know, for the beginners, they're going to be totally lost by any of this. Purely, by definition, resistance is unrelated to the frequency of the current. It is frequency agnostic loss due to usually heat. There are things like radiation resistance, which aren't really truly that definition of resistance. Instead of the heat loss, it's RF loss. Impedance is a complex number which is made up of the quote imaginary J of reactants, either inductive or capacitive, and resistance. It's basically like Pythagorean theorem. If you square the values of both and get the hypotenuse, that's the effective impedance, and the phase angle between the current and the voltage is the angle of that right triangle that you've drawn in your head. So that's the most simplest way that I could bring this up.
Yeah, and that's also a very good explanation. Interesting fact about the impedance, the two components of the impedance, the capacitive reactor and the inductive reactor. If we say we are concentrating ourselves on the serious resonance, not parallel resonance, serious resonance, and we have those two components, those would be the capacitive reactors and inductive reactors. You may, for those who are more advanced, they may look at the horizontal line on the Smith chart. Everything up and everything down. And then you have a capacitive reactance and a inductive reactance and capacitive reactance. Now, it's not going to be technically correct, but it's going to be like easy to understand. If we say that we have minus one, and we have plus one, and we try to tune them together, we get into the perfect balance. There would be those one, minus one, and plus one would balance itself, like a seesaw. So if we have inductive reactors, the capacitive reactants, and both of them balance each other down on that given frequency only, we have a fully open channel at a certain bandwidth that gives us a perfect match to our transmitter. That means the all power that is coming out of the transmitter is going through that sort of channel. Dr. Roy would probably use better wording because my business is not really easy to understand. And you will have a perfectly matched antenna, perfectly antenna in resonance to that frequency. Let me drop one more time.
It's been on long enough.
I don't understand that. Maybe Dr. Roy.
What you're getting at is the concept of a simple LC filter, if anything simple. A capacitor is said to have a negative reactance, so it's a minus J. An inductor is said to have a positive reactance, which is a positive J. So if you have the same impedance in different directions, the sum of the circuit is zero, and you have a reactance of zero, and it is purely a resistive circuit at that point, and then that gives you a maximum current going through something. So I think that's what you're alluding to. That's the way LC filters work. That's pretty much the way resonant antennas work. You're looking to remove the reactance from the antenna and radiate it purely on the basis of a radiation resistance alone.
Yes, it is a perfect job, Dr. Roy. Good explanation. I love it. One thing that we can add of it, when we look at the resonance frequency of that particular antenna of ours, for our purpose, when we take the bandwidth of 7 megahertz, so let's say we want our antenna to generate, to be good at from 700 megahertz to 7300, or 14 to 1450. We want not only one single frequency, we don't want it to be narrow. So that the resonance point is not one single frequency, it's not 1400.1. It has a certain bandwidth and we are interested that our antenna, whichever antenna we choose, has a certain good bandwidth where that serious resonance is there. Now, when you're saying that it's purely resistive, you're absolutely right, but the thing is that resistive is omittable mostly, because the value of the resistive component is insignificant. Do you agree with that?
Well, it depends upon what you're talking about. If you're talking about real heat-producing resistance, yes. If you're talking about effective radiation resistance, no, because in a well-tuned resonance antenna, the overwhelming amount of, quote, resistance, end quote, is radiative resistance, and that's about 50 ohms, so that's a lot. So it sort of depends on semantics, unfortunately, once again. If you're talking about true resistance, where the energy is turned into waste heat, you are correct. If you're using the much more general engineering term that includes radiation resistance, no.
In a receiving antenna, the radiation resistance represents the source resistance of an antenna. That would be a Thevenin equivalent source of power. Due to the electromagnetic reciprocity, an antenna has the same radiation resistance when receiving ratio. Radio waves when transmitting. I don't see in here exactly that which you pointed at.
So we're equal, because I'm not quite sure what point you're trying to make there. I'm just telling you the statement that the 50 ohms of impedance for a resonant dipole, this 50 ohms is effectively resistive, but it does not produce heat because that's waste and you wouldn't get anywhere. It's producing an equivalent resistance that, instead of going into waste heat, is going to the radiation of electromagnetic energy into the air and propagating to the antenna of your fellow ham.
The simplest way for some guys to understand it is goes to the calculation of radiation resistance of antennas. That is, just if you put in Google calculation of radiation resistance of an antenna, you get to calculator, and then you have all of the components that are important and to exchange.
Okay, like I've always said, Google is your friend. So when in doubt, go to Google and read more than one article, because every so often there's a kind of wacky article out there, kind of where some guy makes stuff up, like the electronic universe, or people who don't believe in gravity and think gravity is an electromagnetic phenomenon, which it decidedly isn't, but go to Google.
Could you say a little bit more about the electromagnetic character of gravity?
Well, as I mentioned before, basically there is none. Gravity is the distortion of space-time, and electromagnetism is a potential difference in the electromagnetic field that permeates the vacuum of space. So they're not directly related. They're two of the four classical fundamental interactions of physics.
Yes, I agree. One of the most exciting ideas of modern physics is gravity. So it was kind of abandoned because people couldn't do anything about it, but it is not a traditional force like electromagnetic or nuclear forces. Instead, it is an emergent phenomenon that is merely, that merely looks like traditional force. And to exist.
Well, unfortunately, it depends what church you go to, if you, you want to broaden the term church. On the basis of general relativity, gravity, as you mentioned, is a geometric phenomenon. It is the distortion of space-time itself, and there's no gravity field, and there's no gravity particles. It's simply the warpage of space-time. If you go over to the guys in the quantum mechanics lab, they'll have a problem with you. They would really like to have a particle that's a force, a carrier for gravity called the graviton. They even have selected its spin of zero and other qualities, and they would really, really love someone to figure out quantum gravity, which no one has wrapped their head around much. Now, as far as black holes and Hawking radiation, Stephen Hawking has actually discerned a very small aspect of quantum gravity in a very special case of a black hole at a very great distance, which is the explanation for his Hawking's radiation. But this is a very, very limited case that cannot be broadened and requires much more thorough theory. So if anyone out there has a theory for quantum gravity, just publish it and expect to get your Nobel Prize in about 5 years.
It looks like there is nobody, but there has few words.
Okay, Wes, what's your few words?
I said that the gravity was abandoned for a very long time, and it's just recently in the focus of physicists. So there were, surprisingly, that were few people who were trying to see gravity in connection with electromagnetism. But starting from Faraday and Maxwell and Lorentz, Heaviside and others, there was Weber, there was Donner in 1882. They proposed concept of gravity based on the difference between the forces of attraction or repulsion of electrical charges, which make up all of the body. In the book of Donner. Look what time it was. We're talking about something very interesting in physics. We have a model. So physics is based on models. We happen to be feeling a discomfort with the model. And we have a new model that is rising, like a Big Bang wasn't there a long time ago. Then we switch into another model. And if all of the physicists agree to it, then we have a new approach to physics. Let me drop.
Move on.
A few more. Move on, please. Give me a call, sir. Okay. So move on doesn't have a call sign. Don't talk, because you don't have a call sign, sir. Okay. Then we have Cambridge fundamental theory. That would be 1946. And that was the article given in the simple case where obviously you have a deal with possible action, and that is postulating actually the same. And then we have a Lorentz article, Reflection of Gravity, in 1900, and that again we have 1900. So then there was plenty of others who were actually moving with a new understanding of gravity. There was an article in 1959, now it's more to our modern times, there was a Newton's law explaining that observed expansion of the universe the Blackett Moore law and the magnetic movement of heavenly bodies as the number of facts, and also they were looking for the electron and proton movement in terms of electromagnetism. Till the last one, Russians. Russians still today, they are trying to promote that electromagnetic nature of gravity. Institute of Mathematics and Mathematical Modeling, Ministry of Education of Science of the Republic of Kazakhstan is doing the same, and plenty of others. So it is Polish, let's say Polish guys, Polish Academy of Science. They were for the moment speculating in the Soviet time about this phenomenon as the electromagnetic, but then they gave up on it. And then we have recent times, and Dr. Roy, you can say about the experiments that they had and the structure that they have built in order to really get the gravitation wave. And to
exchange. Question. Yes, you have a question?
KD2BCQ. No disrespect, but I'm just wondering if I miss something. The conversation that I'm hearing is fascinating. I've thought a lot about it, but I mean, did I miss a connection between this conversation and radio? Is there some particular understanding I should have in listening to this conversation as it pertains to radio?
Not particularly. We kind of veered into blue sky. You know, when I start to go off on quantum mechanics and general relativity, it's unfortunately not terribly well directed at amateur radio. Electrical engineers are kind of taught mostly classical physics. Quantum mechanics is a little on the esoteric side and doesn't really manifest itself in the world that we think we live in. Wes is going a little esoteric, it's already 9:40. So unless someone has a specific question, I thought it's always nice to jump in and discuss gravity waves.
Sure, that's no problem. Like I said, I find it fascinating. I just wanted to make sure I didn't miss something because I was trying to make a connection in my head and I couldn't. I mean, I've always thought of it. Relative to quantum physics, the Big Bang, it always occurred to me that in order for there to be a Big Bang, there had to be something leading up to it. And I always thought of maybe as the Big Bang as like a transformative focal point. And as that relates to gravity and the expansion of the universe, there has to be some way to, there has to be some measurable component to gravity. It does exist. We can see it in reaction between planets and different. I always thought gravity was relative to mass.
Well, yes. As I said before, as we understand it right now, gravity is an emergent quality due to the warpage of space-time, either due to mass or energy. Because the mass is simply a different form of energy. Highly concentrated energy is identical to mass. So it is possible to have a bright enough light source, say, that it will manifest as its own black hole. And there's even a fancy, lovely German name for a Kugelblaster or something like that. So that's what it amounts to. General relativity has made all kinds of comments about that. And getting back to the Big Bang, there was a wonderful symmetrical idea that there was a Big Bang and a Big Crunch, and the universe just kept on going through cycles until a couple of guys figured out that it's not slowing down. It keeps on speeding up as it flies away from us. So we have to think of something a little bit more subtle than the Big Crunch, Big Bang cycles of the Big Bang.
I think in terms of novas, a collapsing star, as it collapses on itself, and the gravity, and as the mass increases, the gravity increases, and then at some point it goes nova. I mean, why couldn't there be a similar event, maybe a nomenclature or verbiage, we call it a Big Bang. Maybe it was similar in nature to some type of supernova where there was all the mass in the universe collapsing in on itself, and at some point it went supernova, and we call that the Big Bang.
One more thing.
Nick, K2RIW had an interesting theory. He thought that before this universe there was a black hole, and at some point it became unstable, although there is no theoretical basis for a mass that would be unstable for a black hole. If anything, the black holes radiate Hawking's radiation, so they actually dissipate over time. But the problem is the radiation increases as the mass decreases. So a little tiny pinhole-sized black hole could evaporate in a short period of time. A massive one will take an eternity. So you'd have to theorize what would make a black hole disintegrate. When you're talking about novas and supernovas, you're not talking about black holes. You're talking about stars that run out of fuel to maintain themselves, that implode because under a high enough mass, the particles have a lot of problems dealing with it. And unless it becomes a very critical, very large mass, the reaction is usually an explosion all over the place, and sometimes it studs the area with fragments of heavy atoms like gold that's seen in supernovas. But they're not really black holes. They can become, the core can end up being a black hole, but that's not the same thing. Black holes don't explode. Yes, Wesley?
If we finally got into a little bit into the science section, you don't forget after I finish, you mentioned about laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory, LIGO. Coming back to that, last week we had a discussion when me and Dr. Hans, we were proposing something that modern science didn't get to yet. That means it's a quite novel way of explaining what was before the Big Bang. So the proposed was a long time before the Big Bang there was a equilibrium. So it was like you could imagine yourself the seesaw, and the seesaw was left in a certain stage, and nobody touches for billions of years. It's going to stay there. And since you have equilibrium, nothing is there. So let's say we have a complete emptiness. We got to keep in mind that energy is mass, and mass is energy. That means we can look at mass as energy, and energy could be transferred to mass and reverse. Well, the easiest way to explain that would be you have a coal, you burn the coal, you have energy. Now you can measure the amount of mass that is left there, and you could see how much energy was released. That was one of the way. The other way would be a calorimetry that would give you more accurate information. But let's come back to what was before the Big Bang. So it was equilibrium. So from one hand, it is a very courageous statement. There was no energy. Let's say if we have equilibrium, we don't know what is on left and what is on right. We don't know which position is seesaw if you don't have eyes to see it. We just have equilibrium. So nothing moves, nothing is disturbed. At some point, somewhere in the universe, there was some disturbance to the equilibrium. And now, the proof of the sign is that energy manifests itself. And then, when it manifests itself, and let's say it was in nature of electrostatic, doesn't have to be electrostatic, but we just taking it as electrostatic, it just puts whatever was there around. And that was the beginning of concentration of the energy in the certain point. hostility to God after so long amount of time, and then we have a birth of gravitation, of anything else, of all of the forces, till it got to the point that we had a Big Bang. Because it was so much concentrated that it had to explode. Then when it explodes mostly in form of mass, with the energy pushing it out of the point of explosion. And then all of those particles having their own gravity were actually collecting the smaller particles, and then we have a birth of the planets and the stars. And then we have all of the processes which are connected to the black holes and the quasars and any other solar bodies. So that was something that I never met in the scientific literature. Dr. Roy.
AC2GS. Wes, I don't want to kind of do this all over again because we kind of did it last week. But the problem is the terms of what happened before the beginning is very problematic because the concept underlying the basic of Big Bang Theory is that at time zero, there was a singularity, whatever that means, and that singularity exploded due to a quantum imbalance and blew up into our universe. It's difficult conceptually to explain what happened at minus 1 second because the time doesn't go in reverse. So you either have to define a pre-state without the benefit of any proof that anything exists, or else you just say that it just started with the Big Bang. But I don't want to get too much into the weeds this week because we went into the weeds last week.
I absolutely agree with you. Absolutely agree. But the in order for me to formulate before Big Bang scenario was to provoke you, because when everybody says yes, there is no progress. The progress is from different of valences of different of means, and we did it last week. Yes, thank you. Could you say a few words about legal?
Okay, I mean, we discussed it before, but I'll give people a kind of quick summation for those who weren't listening at that time. There are things called interferometers, specifically Michelson interferometers. If you Google it, you'll find some beautiful illustrations of how they're designed and how they work. It goes historically all the way back to the turn of the previous century. Michelson, unfortunately, wanted to prove that there was actually some esoteric fabric, some substance that permeated space, and it wasn't a vacuum. So that was his way of testing that, and unfortunately for him, it failed because there wasn't anything. The vacuum is the vacuum. Light travels in a vacuum. 19th century physicists really had a hard time coping with that. But he left us the Michelson interferometer. They scaled it up. They put it in a very stable environment. And what it effectively does is it's so sensitive, it can tell when space-time warp is changing. It can't give you a quantitative measurement, a static measurement of space-time warpage, but it can read fluctuations in space-time. And if you have highly massive objects spinning around each other and falling into each other, that imbalance produces waves, ripples of alternating deviations in space-time, which is then picked up at the Michelson interferometer. And we're talking about distances of a neutron, very minimal distances, but it kind of fans out. So that's the basis of gravity waves. Gravity waves are not the same as gravitational waves are not the same as waves of gravity. They're distortions in space-time over time, fluctuations, if you will.
You use the term space-time, and I believe some of the people might not be great knowledge in that. So if you could explain that, other than the concept of time and the tri-dimensional space regarded as a focused four-dimension continuum, if you could use any kind of wording that would be more consumable and tricky.
Okay, the short migraine-free version of this is that the universe is basically defined by three dimensions of space, X, Y, Z. You could call it anything you want. They're at right angles to each other. You can only have three axes at right angles in our space. There might be hyper-dimensional places someplace else where you could measure more than three right angles in different directions, but here it's three. So you have three spatial dimensions. You have one temporal dimension. They are not separate things. They are knitted to each other. If you change the velocity that you travel in through a spatial dimension, you change the velocity that you travel through time itself. As you approach the speed of light in one direction through one aspect of space, effectively your traveling through time stops, which is why anything with mass can't travel at the speed of light, because time has to exist for you. So that's kind of the very small version. Everything is space-time, and they're all hooked together, and one affects the other. If you affect time, you affect space. If you affect space, you affect time. So that's the nature of space-time, I guess.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's better. I have a tendency to complicate things because of lack of wording. So, yeah, I like that the relativity effects that rise from traveling near the speed of light, as well as motion of the massive objects in the universe. That's one of the approaches. The other approaches would be a mathematical model which focuses the three dimension of space and one dimension of time into single four-dimensional manifold. So the space-time can be used to visualize relativistic effects such as way different way different observers perceive differently where the events occur. So if you could just say a few words about different observers, that might be helpful.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Something to contemplate tonight, thinking outside the box here, as a rank amateur, but we always talk about multi-dimensional space, three dimensions of space, one dimension of time. What if we were to consider time as having more than one dimension? Does that make any sense in anybody's mind at all, or is that just totally whack?
Well, it's a very interesting concept. Most of the hyperdimensional chit-chat that I've tended to read about are more spatial, multi-spatial dimensions. Because whether it's because it doesn't exist or because my brain can't wrap myself around it, is what two different time axes would actually be.
Question, this is KG2DCQ.
Yes, George.
Talking about dimensional, or space, or dimensional anything, isn't dimensional space something that we apply to the universe so that we can understand it? And in that limitation, is it possible that there are other dimensions out there that we just haven't defined yet because we can't observe them?
Okay, that has the kernel of a very interesting but possibly confusing concept or story. Basically, we can't measure anything but three dimensions. So the best that we can go on is that we live in a three-dimensional, three spatial dimensions, one temporal dimension universe. There are theories that our four-dimensional space-time universe is embedded in a multiverse that might be higher dimensional. There are also theories that in our universe, those other dimensions sort of exist, but they are so sharply curled in on themselves that because we are unable to test anything at those incredibly short distances, we can't perceive those extra dimensions. How's that?
I absolutely agree. I think that's the reason we only have three dimensions is our limited understanding of the universe. I mean, I often hear about a thing about like mirror universes or reverse universes and things like that, and it could be that we are just in our own little mental universe and having our three dimensions trying to understand the world and universe around us. And I think that's part of man's search for, you know, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's a quest. I'm sure that when they first invented fire, nobody was talking about quantum physics or time-space or anything like that. So, I mean, we've evolved to this understanding of multidimensional space, and I think the only limit to that at this point is man's understanding.
Well, I mean, man's understanding is always a limitation, but if the extra dimensions do exist, but they are curled in on themselves and the entirety of them take up the space of, say, 1/1000th of a neutron, then effectively they're kind of immaterial because we can't get that close to anything. Now, there are people who are hoping that they can, and there are tests to see if gravity is part of it. One of the theories of a higher multidimensional hyper-universe, if you will, is that the reason why gravity is the weakest force of the four fundamental interactions, by an order of 1 to 31 zeros, something like that. So the question is, why is gravity so darn weak? Well, relativistic people will tell you because it's not really a force. It's curvature of space-time. But the quantum mechanics people really don't like that. So what they would like to think of is that what's happening with gravity is it's bleeding away in an extra dimension we're not aware of. You can't tell that unless you get two objects and measure their gravitational force at that distance that the extra dimensions might be curled into. So they're trying to put objects closer and closer and closer together to see if the gravitational force reads a strange number that it shouldn't. So far they've been unsuccessful, but they haven't gone that close.
Okay. Well, thinking in terms of that, I mean, if I think sometimes, well, if you think of the Big Bang, I mean, I think in terms of the super colliders that they have today, I don't know if you consider BNL a super collider, but CERN super colliders, where you have a target and a moment of impact. I'm not sure what they call that, the incident or whatever the hell it is. I'm sorry, whatever it is, you have the incident where you target this element or whatever it is, and you have a moment of impact, and you measure the result of that impact on all types of detectors, and you can tell what existed as a result of that impact. If you take and apply that to maybe the Big Bang, if there was a way to measure the resulting universe after the Big Bang, you could imagine what it looked like as the original element, target element, before, element might be the wrong verbiage or terminology, but I mean, understanding the universe beyond the Big Bang would, in my mind, shed light onto whatever was previous or prior to the Big Bang would give you a better understanding or vision of what that was, and it might then help you understand our own current situation better.
And it's a reasonable idea and premise, and to a degree we're doing that. We're trying to find more secrets from objects. We found the Higgs boson by creating, it's very unstable and requires high energies to bring it into creation for a fraction of a second and then it decays away into far more esoteric, non-esoteric stuff. The problem, though, is the orders of magnitude. The most powerful atom smasher that we could possibly design is nowhere near the Big Bang. It's nowhere near that suns, novas, supernovas, what have you. It would be like trying to figure out how an atomic bomb works by testing a firecracker.
Yeah, I guess I understand that, sure. Again, as being a novice, I'm going to just, you can only state